21, 41, 78, and 22, 31, 82. Sherry Lack versus Benefits Committee, Western and Southern Financial Group Company, Flexible Benefits Plan et al. Oral argument, 15 minutes per side. Mr. Abrams for the defendants' appellants.
I'm not sure whether that notice, the initial notice, was sufficient then on that.
Judge O'Malley,
things on that. First, the district court didn't remand to do anything over on chronic pain syndrome. It rendered an interpretation of chronic pain syndrome that is not set forth in the plan that we disagree with and set forth in the briefs. As to the notice issue, that was one aspect of the remand. I would say sort of an alternative holding for the district court. The primary basis for the remand was that the district court viewed the long-term disability benefits definition, which is in 2.3b of the plan, as setting forth sort of a two-phase process. We have these benefits for 24 months and then beyond 24 months, and you can only look at the beyond 24 months after the first 2 years of benefits expire. That is not, there's no process whatsoever for that plan. It's recognized by the appellee at page 47 of her brief. No plan provision suggests that there's going to be a reassessment of the change in disability date. We have deposition testimony in the record. Somebody who's been with this company for 25 years, who says he's always assessed this. When you file for benefits, it was like you filed a claim back in 2016. The ruling was made on chronic pain syndrome. And I think to get to your question more specifically about notice, Judge Nalbandian, you have to look at what she asked for in her administrative appeal, because the 24 months of benefits have already been reported. Those have been paid. So we weren't really re-looking at, okay, well, was that initial determination correct? Should we reverse on 24 months of benefits that we awarded? She said in her appeal, I meet the standard for long-term disability benefits beyond 24 months. The district court relied on the MacArthur case and its decision for the notice issue. There, the claimant was completely blindsided with a new explanation for the denial in an appeal denial letter at the administrative level. In this case, we don't have that because we have the claimant actually asking us to decide the question. So under the Sixth Circuit test for substantial compliance for the notice requirement, where you look at every communication from the plan to the claimant, to the claimant to the plan, our position is that...
My understanding is, in order for her to be denied the benefits, she had to be essentially unable to work and it not be from chronic pain syndrome as defined wherever. We can go back and forth on that. But I guess my question is, the notice said you are not getting benefits because of chronic pain. Doesn't seem to give a little... There's not a lot of elaboration there, honestly. It doesn't say that you are able to work or are able to find another job, does it?
The appeal denial notice does say that, and that's
the initial denial, not the appeal.
The initial denial is based solely on chronic pain, and she's given 24 months of benefits for that. So the appeal comes up.
But the initial denial also denies permanent long-term benefits too, doesn't it?
Yeah, because she's limited to 24 months of benefits. So then the appeal comes up and she says she doesn't submit any new evidence. You got to think about the purpose of the notice requirement here. It's so that...
Right, yeah, yeah, it's to submit new evidence. But the letter doesn't say you can get another job and you should provide us some evidence of how you can't get another job. That's what I'm saying, is I don't see how the initial denial gave her enough notice. I think your argument is, well, it doesn't really matter. She should have known based on the totality of the case, circumstances, and the fact that we denied it, that we necessarily thought that you could get another job or something, I assume. Is that your argument?
I would say two things. One is that she argued in her appeal letter that she met the standard, so she wanted us to consider it. All of her medical records had already been submitted. It's unclear what else could have been submitted. And if you look at... Okay, assume there was a notice violation. What's the remedy? The Sixth Circuit, for a notice violation, the remedy is always remand back to the administrative level. And the result here simply would not change if we're looking at ability to work.
But what I'm saying is so the remedy is remand, which is what Judge Rosler did. But he sat there and he said, hey, your notice wasn't sufficient. I'm remanding back for some more stuff to happen. So why is that not? And you're saying, well, he erred. He shouldn't have remanded. He should have basically just affirmed the denial of benefits under an arbitrary and capricious standard. But you just said, look, the violation, if there is a notice violation, why isn't remand the right remedy?
Sure, because the remand here wasn't simply to correct a notice issue. The remand here was to modify the long-term disability assessment and make us look at that question again as of a different timeline, not when she applied for benefits in 2016 and we rendered the decision in 2017. It was remand, and I believe that the plan requires you to assess that question in October of 2018 when the 24 months of benefits expires.
Tell me the difference between this benefits department and the benefits committee. Who made this decision, and was it the correct committee or whatever was supposed to do it under the plan?
Well, Judge Seiler, in the first decision, it wasn't in dispute. The benefits department is noted in the plan as assisting the benefits committee, which is the named plan administrator.
And are they the same thing?
No, they're not the same thing. The benefits committee is the named plan administrator, and the plan allows it to engage others to assist it. The benefits committee is, I mean, I can't tell you, six or seven individuals, executives at Western and Southern New York oversee globally the administration of the plan. The benefits department is a business unit within Western and Southern with, 40, 50 employees, and they assist with claim administration which is one part of plan administration. So
doesn't the benefits committee have its own quorum requirement for making a decision?
There is a quorum requirement in the plan, Judge Navandia, but
so
I don't believe it
applies.
You
can't use the assist language to get around the quorum, right? Could they delegate, hey, look, we need three people here to make a decision. Let's just delegate it to the benefits committee or whatever. Let's just delegate it, and they can make a decision, and that way we never have to have a quorum.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, the court doesn't ever need to get there, first of all. Second of all, if it does, the quorum requirement
Don't we have to make a decision about whether de novo review applies to the second decision?
If we
disagree with you on the first part on remand?
If you disagree and do not reverse on the first decision, then you would be looking at the second decision. Yes, you would have to decide the applicable standard of review. I think the plan here for the second decision can decide whether it's de novo or arbitrary and capricious. And I think the quorum requirement doesn't really apply to these individual claim adjudications. I think you have to read that language in connection with the other parts of the plan that say they can engage others to assist it in plan administration. And I think Judge Seiler can run into a similar plan language in the Bridgewater case, which we cited in our brief, or the plan there delegated an administrative committee.
But I just seem like these other cases, the language in the plan is a little bit more explicit than the language in your plan about delegation, about decision making. I mean, assist to me is not a delegation of power. Would you agree? If I say I can get all these people to assist me, it doesn't mean that I can delegate to them decision making authority, does it? Just a plain language of assist.
I disagree, Your Honor, because number one, verse on the Bridgewater case, that exact language is used. The administrative committee is the named plan administrator. The decision is rendered by a claims review committee. The plaintiff says the wrong person decided my claim. This court reviews the language of the plan, which says the administrative committee can engage others to assist it, and there was no issue.
Okay, all right.
That's good. Those questions to follow up, not on this point, but on the notice point that Judge Albanian was asking you about. I don't know if I followed all that entirely, but with respect to Judge Bertelsmann's second decision, did he cite any notice issue there with respect to the denial of the...
No.
So that was not an issue. Notice with respect to the denial of total benefits beyond 24 months, he didn't find any notice problem. He just said the de novo review rather than arbitrary and capricious, and then found for the other side.
That's correct. The notice is sort of peripheral here because the ultimate issue is what is the time period for the assessment of the inability to work. Just remand based on a notice issue, that's easily cured. And probably a useless formality under this court's decisions in Judge and Kent because we have a treating physician.
I was just asking what Judge Bertelsmann hung up about notice. Obviously, he didn't find for you, but it wasn't on notice. It wasn't a notice grounds.
In the November 2021 decision, notice was not an issue. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. You'll have to rebuttal.
Thank you. ultimately concluded in 2021 after, in 2020, I'm sorry, after 4 years of litigation, that Ms. Lakey is clearly entitled to long-term disability benefits under the plan.
The motion is
Is that better? The district court confidently concluded that Ms. Lakey satisfied her burden under the plan, establishing that she's disabled from any and every occupation beyond October 2018. In support of that conclusion, Judge Bertelsmann looked at Western Southern's own paid file reviewer, who concluded that she would be unable to work in even a sedentary occupation, that she'd be unable to walk for more than 15 minutes, 1 hour per day, that she'd be unable to stand.
When was that evaluation done?
That one was performed in 2019.
Was this Dr. Kramer or someone else?
Same Dr. Kramer.
Okay, well, Dr. Kramer said that she didn't meet the disability standard for permanent benefits.
Dr. Kramer concluded that she did not believe she was asked to interpret the plan's definition of disability. And this circuit regularly concludes that a task of the plan administrator, not the doctor. When you look at Dr. Kramer's actual limitations, she lists a litany of them, and she explains that
that's your best evidence is Dr. Kramer?
No.
Okay, well, that's what you're talking about, because Dr. Kramer came out in my reading the other way.
Okay, well, I respectfully disagree.
It was also the most timely. It was the one that was done closest. It was done right at the time that the long-term or the permanent benefits would have started.
That one was performed in September 2019.
That was performed or not finished?
Completed.
Yeah, it wasn't performed. I thought it was performed earlier.
In June, you're right. June 2019, after 6 months...
I thought that was the best evidence for the other side, and you're saying that's your best evidence.
No, what I'm saying is that they relied on that without applying the restrictions that she provided to establish whether that meets the definition of disability or not. At the same time, she showed in her report, the 2019 versus the 2017 report, it shows that her condition severely deteriorated during that time period. In addition, Drs. Montel and Dr. Isley both submitted medical source statements that are more timely than Dr. Kramer's, and they were just a couple months after the court's remand order, in which they concluded that she couldn't sit, stand.
If there's some evidence that suggests that she could perform some other job, okay, and wouldn't meet the definition, even if there's some dispute, it wouldn't be arbitrary and capricious for the plan to deny the benefits at that point, right? I mean, if somebody says, if some doc looks at her and says, yeah, I don't think she meets the definition, and they say, okay, I don't know, that wouldn't be arbitrary and capricious to me, would it?
It depends on the circumstances. It depends on the basis for that opinion. If, for instance, Dr. Kramer's 2019 report, that was the result of a truncated records, Western Southern truncated the records that they gave her. We submitted over 350 pages on appeal. Western Southern's general counsel and members who are not part of the plan, benefits committee or the benefits department, decided to remove those records that they didn't want her to review, gave them to her, gave part of those records to her, and then asked her. The records that they gave her, I'm sorry, were up to October 16th, 2018. Anything after that, they excluded. So she couldn't review or consider a complete record as required under the claims regulations for full and fair review. She calls Dr. Montel because it's a year later, and she asks to get an update. So she states in her report she needed an update from Dr. Montel without the ability to consult Dr. Montel's own functional capacity statement saying that she was disabled.
What's the most egregious thing that the company did here, because Judge Bertelsmann imposed a lot of penalties here? Is it one thing or just everything?
It's everything combined over a significant period of time. Even basic things like who is on the benefits committee, who is in the benefits department, is subject to change according to their position. They took one position in the first round of litigation that Mike Altano, who's general counsel, was in the benefits department, and then changed it in the second round of litigation, said, oh wait, he's not part of the benefits department. They had executives for the company, not executives or not agents of benefits department. They had company plan sponsor executives come into these meetings and vote to deny the claim. And then on remand,
those people who were on neither the committee,
correct,
or the
correct HR executives. And then on remand, the same people, Mike Altano, Steve Hussey, and Dr. Clark, engage in these private meetings without the benefits department or a quorum of the benefits committee together and decide issues such as, are we going to truncate the records that we give to a doctor to review the file?
There may be, form and substance. Formally, maybe the committee made a decision, maybe the department made a decision. Maybe that wasn't 100% in accord with what the documents say, although the documents also say that the committee has broad discretion to bring in others as it needs. But these are all Western Southern employees.
Correct. Western Southern.
All these people. Everyone is people.
No. Well, some are retired. I believe some individuals on the benefits committee are retired executives who no longer are employees. But
current or former. In other words, what's the harm here? What's the prejudice? So we have cases that say if everyone's sort of under the same corporate name and company, doesn't necessarily matter who's made the review as long as there's a final determination.
Well, that would invalidate the entire purpose of having an appropriately named fiduciary review a claim. That would mean that the CEO of Western Southern can come into this meeting and decide to deny Ms. Lakey's claim and decide, whether to vote on to deny it or not.
Because
no one's going to vote against
that person's on either the committee or the department, or because that person's on the committee and they can't show up to the department meetings.
Under the terms of the plan specifically limits discretion and authority to decide a claim to the plan administrator. The plan administrator is the benefits committee. The benefits committee must operate under specific procedures, like this court has mentioned, the quorum and the majority vote. And this court holds regularly that failure to follow this specific plan procedures is in itself a...
Well, there was a determination. There was a determination and a right to appeal, right? There was a determination and a right to appeal that which they did, which you did. I'm just not sure what's the prejudice? If this is a criminal case, what was this prejudice or harmless error?
Because each round, we disagree with my colleague's statement that there was no notice issues. The first decision on remand in 2019, Western and Southern, they write a denial letter. They do not reference Dr. Kramer's new report or include the restrictions and limitations or explain the basis for that decision. We appeal it, stating, hey, this is, and by the way, that decision came 270 days after the court's remand order. It took a significant amount of time and with no excuse, really. But then we submitted on our appeal information in our position that she remained disabled under both definitions of disability. Instead of analyzing our position about the definition of total disability, whether or not she met that standard, it was ignored. And then they have this other, post-litigation doctor, file reviewer, write an opinion, which is facially unreliable. He adds new diagnoses.
This is part of I'm kind of lost as well.
Sorry, this person's name is Dr. Lyarski.
Can I go back? Are you saying before I went to district court, they never put Dr. Kramer forward as the reason partly why they denied benefits, the long-term benefits, the complete benefits, the lifelong benefits? disability?
I'm sorry, ask
the are you saying they hit the ball on Dr. Kramer until you got to federal court and then they presented it to you?
No.
Okay, so...
No. I apologize for
that. That's okay. I'm still trying to understand what the prejudice here was. I mean, maybe there's notice the first time around, but it went back down, and when you came up on the denial of total disability because there was some job your client could perform, you had that information given to you by the company during the administrative review process. They came up to appeal, and Judge Burlesman agreed with you. Judge Burlesman then didn't give them the benefit of arbitrary and capricious, but...
Judge Burlesman also ruled that if the case were reviewed under the arbitrary and capricious standard, it would certainly meet that standard. Part of that goes to, you know, if the plan administrator is not following the claims regulations, that's in and of itself an arbitrary and capricious a denial.
That's the issue we just talked about. And I was right,
the claims regulations. The ERISA claim regulations dictate expressly not just what is included in a denial letter, but also how a claim is reviewed. Whether they provide a full and fair review, if they give sufficient information, opportunity to respond to that information, a claims procedure which is not a bar to receiving those benefits. And
so there are a lot of doctors who looked at it.
And they all agreed, except for Dr. Lyarsky, who Judge Burlesman, within his discretion, viewed as outside the administrative record.
There are a lot of doctors that reviewed it. The company made a decision. It was first, you know, got the first 24 months, didn't get the rest.
Both definitions of disability are functionally equivalent. Western Southern has not explained, despite arguments for requests in the administrative process and on litigation, to explain what the difference is. How can one be totally disabled from any occupation, but simultaneously not disabled from any and every occupation? It defies logic.
You asked Judge Burlesman to apply de novo review and not arbitrary and capricious on what specific basis?
Pursuant to Vanderklok, in which he states that egregious procedural irregularities merit the de novo review.
Can I ask you, those procedural irregularities, were they with respect to the medical review part of it, or with respect to the plan documents that you said you didn't get or didn't get them on top, or a combination of those things?
With respect to Western Southern's egregious delay in beginning to process their claim on remand. They waited months. We had to check in on the status, and then after that, that was May when we checked in on the status. They hadn't begun anything yet after 3 months.
Wait, I thought the question was about the standard. You asked for de novo review.
We asked for de novo review on two grounds.
On the benefits committee versus the benefits department making the decision, right, or not?
With a nuance to that. The primary request for de novo review is based on unauthorized individuals who are non-fiduciaries under the plan making decisions. So they're members who are not even part of the benefits
committee. So not the benefits committee, whatever that is.
Correct.
I mean, that's the way I read Judge Bertelsmann's decision to apply de novo review, that it was based on that. Okay, and then is the delay also a basis for
that? That was our argument. He didn't respond to that.
Is there support for that? That if you wait, is it deemed a denial and therefore you would review a de novo, or is it just a procedural error but one of the penalties are supposed to be de novo review?
Generally, it would be deemed a denial, but there are, Vanderklok, the court also says for egregious procedural irregularities, de novo review can be the remedy.
Okay, but Judge Bertelsmann didn't. I know he cited the delay in terms of limiting what the administrative record was going to be, right? But not, I don't know that, recall that he cited it as part of the de novo review. Okay, but you made that argument.
Correct.
Can I ask you a question? One of the sanctions issues or penalties or whatever, as I recall, was the failure to provide the 2019... one of the summary plan descriptions and also a trust agreement that I'm struggling to see how those documents were relevant at all in the case. Are they relevant to something?
Yes, they're relevant. The 2019 plan was amended to include a new definition of chronic pain syndrome. In our mind, that would go to their argument about the definition of chronic pain syndrome as it existed in. And then the trust document also diverges from the plan document in naming who the plan administrator is. That's an additional prejudice that Ms. Leahy suffered. There were other documents that were the court found to be outside of the statute of limitations that Western Southern withheld over a period of years, which also significantly prejudiced her, but he did not impose penalties
on those. Okay, all right, thank you.
I just kind of follow up on that. I know at one point you asked for all relevant documents. Then did you make specific requests after? So you get some documents. And, you know, I'm analogizing this to like the civil discovery process. Did you then follow up and say, I specifically want the 2019 document or the 2020 document? Or this was like way after the fact, actually.
We asked, every time there's a denial, we submitted a request for all relevant documents as they're defined in the claims regulations, which includes plans that or documents that the plan is operated under. And Western Southern responded each time saying that they would provide this summary plan description, for instance, but did not. So they had clear notice that that was a relevant document that we were requesting.
Thank you. Rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, I'd just like to say I think the procedural issues here are irrelevant. One, to the standard of review, we have biomedical applications of Kentucky versus Cole Exclusive Company. That's a Judge Tappar decision from the Eastern District of Kentucky. Quote, In the Sixth Circuit, procedural errors do not convert the standard of review from arbitrary and capricious to de novo. And as I spoke earlier, if there is a procedural issue, then the best you can get is a remand. It's not a substantive grant of benefits. No Sixth Circuit case has ever held that. And to your point, Judge Nalbandian, if one doctor says that the claimant can work, does that mean it's not arbitrary and capricious? And the answer is yes. Each member of the panel has been on a case where that occurred. Judge Nalbandian was on the Lloyd versus P&G case within the last few years where that occurred. Judge Radler, you were on the Davis case in the last few years, writing for the panel in which that occurred. Judge Seiler, Brown versus FedEx, all of these are within the last 2 or 3 years. The law is crystal clear that even if one independent consultant takes a look at the medical records and concludes that the claimant...
Are you saying this goes back to standard review? Are you saying that there's nothing that would change the standard from arbitrary and capricious to de novo?
Yes, there's the standard review is arbitrary and capricious based on the plan's grant of discretion under Firestone. And
so if I completely disregard the plan procedures and just do whatever I want to do, that gets reviewed for arbitrary and capricious, and we decide, and presumably it would be arbitrary and capricious.
I'm quoting, in the Sixth Circuit, procedural errors do not convert standard review from arbitrary and capricious.
I guess I don't have any context for that statement. What is a procedural error? Is having the benefits committee, I mean, having the development... whatever the other one is, make the decision and not the benefits committee? Is that just a mere procedural error? I mean, that seems like it could be fairly egregious. I don't know. You're supposed to have this. The plan says these five people make this decision. It turns out these other five people make the decision. Is that just a procedural error? Or is that, I mean, it could be nefarious. I don't know.
It's a materiality standard or something. What's a material error versus...
I don't think there's a materiality standard as far as procedural errors changing the standard review. And whether it's classified as a procedural error or not, yeah, I think it's procedure that's set forth in the plan. And I would disagree that it wasn't followed, as we set forth in our brief.
Yeah, I know, but I'm just saying that if every time from now on you said that we're just going to have these five people do it, not the committee, okay, and you say, look, I think that's a fair reading of the plan. And somebody says, no, that's not a fair reading. The court says, no, it's not a fair reading of the plan. And you say, I don't care. I'm going to keep doing it. And because all it is a mere procedural error, so it doesn't matter what I do. It's always going to be arbitrary and capricious for you, right? So these five people will always make the decision, and then we will always use arbitrary and capricious because it's a mere procedural error. And I just don't understand how that could be the case.
I would go back to the plan granting discretion to engage others to assist. And as far as plan administration,
so you are conceding that part, and you're just going back to the regular argument, which is my reading of the plan. If it were my reading, I don't know, but my reading of the plan is just wrong. Assist includes delegation. Is that right?
I stand by the procedural errors do not change the standard review from.
So there's no possible procedural error that could ever be made that would change the standard of review. That may be right, but is that your argument?
I'm not aware of a Sixth Circuit case that has found one, so that's my position. And then secondarily, to respond to your question of whether you just sort of go back and do whatever you want, I don't think that's what's occurring. The same people did this the first time around, and we applied the arbitrary and capricious standard. It was no issue. This isn't nefarious rogue decision-making. We have the same. This is how the plan is operating. The benefits department is engaged. The plan allows the benefits committee to engage people to assist it. Claims administration is not the same thing as plan administration. It's one aspect of it that it is. So you're not really delegating plan administration. It's just they're participating in one aspect of the plan, and as well as the fact that Judge Rayla pointed out, all of these are agents of Western Southern Financial Group. They're all acting on behalf of Western Southern Financial Group. So it's really form of ourselves.
I mean, I hear that, but it seems like it proves too much, right? I mean, you can just pick anybody, as long as they're getting a paycheck from Western Southern, they can make a benefits determination. Because everybody's a fiduciary in Western and Southern to this person.
Well, the analysis in the Davis and the Finwood cases that dealt with Hartford, there were employees of separate entities who were making decisions. And functionally, that was the analysis. So I would fall back to those cases in the course analysis.
Okay. All right.